killed dozens of civilians in central and southern Gaza as the death toll for the regime's genocide tops 29,000, most of them women and children. Doctors Without Borders says Israel's looming attack on the southern Gaza city of Rafah will turn it into a graveyard and heighten the risk of famine. And Palestinian authorities warn more than 700,000 people in northern Gaza are at risk of dying from deepening starvation. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us here on World News. Israeli massacre of Palestinians in Gaza continues to unfold as the regime pounds blockaded territory with airstrikes and artillery now for more than 4 months. The latest attacks, 34 people were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed homes in the Nuseirat and Deir Abala refugee camps in central Gaza. Israeli airstrikes on Rafah in southern Gaza left at least 8 people dead, including children. Another 6 Palestinians were killed after Israeli troops opened fire on the displaced people in Khan Yunis, also in the south of the besieged enclave. Meanwhile, regime continues with its artillery shelling on several neighborhoods of Gaza City, also leading to multiple casualties. Israeli war on Gaza, which began in early October, has so far claimed the lives of nearly 29,200 Palestinians, most of them women and children. Several international aid groups have voiced deep concerns over looming Israeli ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, says the Rafah offensive will turn the southern Gaza city into a graveyard and heighten the looming risk of famine. According to MSF, the consequences of full-scale assault are truly unimaginable. Group says the Rafah, where 1.4 million displaced Palestinians live in crowded shelters, is the end of the line. Meanwhile, Refugees International has warned that attacking Rafah effectively means cutting off the lifelines of people who have lost everything already except for their lives. Group says people in this city are already right on the brink of famine. The warning comes a day after 26 EU countries warned the offensive will worsen an already catastrophic humanitarian situation. They said it also prevent provision of urgently needed basic services and humanitarian aid. And calls are growing for an international probe into reports of physical and sexual abuse of Palestinian detainees inside Israeli jails. The Palestinian Prisoner Society and Detainees Affairs Commission made a request in a joint statement saying there's been a huge surge in horrific accounts given by both male and female prisoners of sexual abuse. Reported cases of harassment have taken place in different occasions during detainees' arrest, interrogation, and detention in Israeli prisons. Some reports reveal other forms of abuse, including threats of rape, severe beatings, use of police dogs, and use of civilians as human shields. On Monday, UN experts expressed grave concern over reported sexual abuse by Palestinian female detainees. Palestinian women in Israeli jails have reportedly been subjected to multiple forms of sexual abuse, with at least 2 of them being raped. Palestinian authorities in Gaza have warned more than 700,000 people are at risk of dying from deepening starvation in northern Gaza. The Gaza Government Media Office issued the warning after the World Food Program announced a halt to its aid deliveries in northern Gaza. World Body argued breakdown of social order caused by mass starvation could endanger the lives of its crew. The government media office slammed that decision, saying it'll further exacerbate a humanitarian crisis. It urged UN agencies to continue to fulfill their duties, and this after the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, warned that Gaza is poised to witness an explosion in preventable child deaths due to a deep rise in malnutrition among children. U.S. once again vetoes the U.N. Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Will those in favor of the draft resolution contained in document S/2024/173 please raise their hand? Those against? Abstentions? The result of the voting is as follows. 13 votes in favor, 1 vote against, 1 abstention.
draft resolution was put forward by Algeria, with the representative urging the international community to act swiftly as the value of a ceasefire reduces with every passing minute. However, the U.S. representative claims the measure will undermine ongoing negotiations mediated by Qatar. And since Gaza genocide started, the U.N. Security Council has tried three times to adopt resolutions for a ceasefire. All attempts have failed, as Washington has vetoed every single one. The Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, condemned the U.S. move, saying it'll give Israel a green light to carry out more massacres. And speaking at the council meeting, the Palestinian envoy slammed the U.S. veto as well, calling it absolutely reckless and dangerous.
The call for ceasefire should have been agreed to long time ago. What threshold needs to be crossed for this council to finally demand a ceasefire? What could be more serious than the crime than genocide? History, as my brother Ammar said, is going to judge the council harshly. It is already doing so, impairing its credibility and authority in the eyes of people all over the world, perhaps irreparably. But we will not be complacent in this inaction. We have a duty to our people to seek every possible pathway to bring an end to the slaughter, an end to the trauma and terror, an end to the threats to expel them from their land. We will not be silent, and we will act with every legitimate means to uphold our sacred obligations to defend and protect our people and to pursue justice for them. That is why we have come back to the Security Council over and over again, imploring it to act to protect our people. That is why we will not relent in seeking accountability, calling on the Council, the General Assembly, and all states to act in line with the Charter and all obligations under international law, without selectivity, without exception.
International human rights lawyer John Philpott says the U.S. has isolated itself by standing against the entire world to protect Israel.
The U.S. is isolated. Their ally is Israel. They keep arming Israel. They talk about civilians and keep arming Israel. And they veto the resolutions which are necessary to save these lives. Israel has no answer, no solution. They have this savage attack on the civilians. We'll see what happens in Rafah. Israel is isolated, United States is isolated, and we see a kind of total break between the entire world and the United States of America. It's a terrible situation. We have the World Court ruling saying that genocide is plausible. This is one of the times when genocide is actually being plausible, because the U.S. cries genocide around the world, but never when there is a real genocide happening, they veto it and try and protect the aggressor.
And tensions between Brazil and Israel are at a boiling point. In the latest move, Brazil is slammed as outrageous recent Israeli top diplomats' remarks against the country's president, Ignacio Lula da Silva. Brazil's foreign minister, Mario Vieira, called Israeli counterpart statements unacceptable in their nature and a lie in content. He said regime's trying to create a smokescreen over its ongoing crimes in Gaza. Now, last week, Lula da Silva compared Israel's genocide in Gaza to what Nazi Germany did during the Second World War. The presidents of Colombia and Bolivia also backed Lula's remarks, asserting Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians. Israel's foreign minister, Israel Katz, reacted to Lula's statement, saying Tel Aviv considers him persona non grata now, adding that Lula is no longer welcome in Israel until he takes his words back. And Tel Aviv also summoned Brazil's ambassador In response, Brazil summoned the Israeli envoy and recalled its ambassador for consultations. Senior officials of Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements Osama Hamdan and Ali Abu Shaheen have held a press conference in the Iranian capital. They addressed a number of issues regarding Israel's ongoing onslaught on Gaza. Let's take a listen.
The developments on the ground have proven that the resistance is capable of the confrontation and that Al-Aqsa Storm achieved victory on October 7. The remnants or members of the occupation army did not succeed, and the resistance is achieving daily victories against the enemy. The enemy admits that this battle has led to 970 tanks being partially or completely destroyed, 550 transport vehicles, military vehicles also, and tens of other vehicles. This would not have taken place were it not for the steadfastness and the heroics of the resistance, whereby all factions of the resistance came together operationally, and this proves that the resistance serves the people, and we promise the resistance will continue with this approach, and any attempt by the enemy to launch an aggression against the enemy, against the resistance, will be met with the heroics and with the resistance. Regarding the political contacts, our stance is clear and firm, and we agreed amongst ourselves, and we can summarize these in four main points. First of all, ending a complete end to the aggression against the Palestinian people, and this includes the withdrawal of the occupation forces from the Gaza Strip, a complete final withdrawal. The second is sending emergency aid to our people, and then launching the reconstruction process and lifting the siege. Regarding the prisoner swaps, this comes after those other demands. This is related to the political context. This stance has not changed despite all of the attempts of the enemy which is trying to violate and not commit to any principles. I would like to reassure you that prolonging the aggression, the Israeli enemy is striving to achieve various goals by prolonging the war. First of all, pinning its hopes on the people exhausting and the surrender of their resistance, it no longer being able to fight for a long period of time. Also pinning its hopes on putting a stop to the support of a Palestinian people. They think that the supportive fronts, if the situation extends, the Palestinian people will cry out, or resistance will cry out. This will not happen. On the contrary, the Israelis, this will backfire against them, because the ability of our people to put up with the difficulties, despite their pains and the sorrows, their ability to tolerate this is or exceeds the ability of the other side. So do not be concerned.
Nigerians are facing one of the West African country's worst economic crises in years, as the currency has fallen to a record low amid soaring inflation. The situation has provoked anger and protests throughout the country.
Shoppers at the popular Wuse market in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, are having tough times as skyrocketing rise in the prices of commodities has taken a heavy toll on ordinary people. Prices of commodities, especially food items, have gone up more than 100%, and indeed, they've continued to rise on a daily basis.
Cost of living is something else. It's terrible. A common man with a salary of 30,000 cannot buy a bag of rice of almost 80,000 naira.
There is hunger, terrible hunger, and high rise of stealing, thief, everything just keep going higher.
Bag of cement, it's like about 9,000, he just bought it. I said, wow, 9,000, where are we going? Bag of rice, 77,000.
Experts say, apart from the economic policy of devaluing the Nigerian currency, removal of multiple exchange rate windows has further weakened the naira against the dollar, resulting in inflation and harsh economic woes to the people. They said grinding poverty has created a sense of hopelessness in an already impoverished population, pushing many people to the edge.
IMF said we should devalue, we are devaluing. But what are the consequences of this on the economy, on the purchasing power parity that has even existed before now? We made money during the windfall when oil was at the price of oil was at its peak in the international oil market. But what did we do with this humongous amount that we made? It was frittered away through corruption.
Experts also say at inception on 29 May 2023, the new government in Nigeria removed the subsidy on petrol, which pushed the prices of petrol up, resulting in the rise of goods and services, which further made things worse for the poor in Nigeria. But they said there are immediate solutions that can bring relief. Pockets of protest over the economic hardship have started springing up in some Nigerian cities. Meanwhile, the Nigerian Labour Congress has called for a two-day nationwide strike on 27 and 28 February in protest over the rising cost of living.
The Nigerian government has promised to take proactive steps to mitigate the economic problems people are facing. Experts, however, say the government should first solve the persistent insecurity in Nigeria to be able to focus on agriculture for food security. They also say human capacity must be developed so that the Nigerian population becomes an asset instead of a liability. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we made you familiar with the views of Irish professor Fred Halliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. Today, we are going to sum up the views of those Western researchers whose views we have presented to you on the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Stay tuned, please. The Islamic Revolution has been focused by many thinkers and researchers across the world due to its unique nature and the unmatched impact it has had on global developments ever since its victory in 1979. Michel Foucault was one of the outstanding thinkers whose views we presented to you briefly on the Islamic Revolution and its peerless leader, Imam Khomeini. The Islamic Revolution emerged in the age when religion had been isolated, especially in the social aspects of life. French thinkers, Foucault, did not follow his contemporaries to call religion as the opium of masses. In fact, this was the famous belief of the German thinker, Karl Marx. Foucault had indeed believed in another statement of Marx, where he had said, "Religion is the spirit of a spiritless world." Foucault considered religion as a generating, converging, and creative force which puts forward a novel kind of discourse and method of living. The French researcher maintained that the Iranian Shah had omitted ordinary, unofficial powers like opposing political parties and groups, neglecting that this would reinforce the dispersed network of power among people. He calls the Shah and the army as the explicit symbol of power and violence against people's congregated and accumulated power. He opines that religion, spirituality, and congregated willpower, coupled with Imam Khomeini's highly influential and charismatic personality, were the core of the Islamic Revolution. In short, Michel Foucault is of the opinion that Iran's Islamic Revolution demonstrated the glory of faith and willpower and the lofty Islamic culture to the world. Ahmed Algar was another thinker who spent years to research on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. This British thinker maintained that the Islamic Revolution would have never gained victory had there not been Imam Khomeini to lead the people. He, like Michel Foucault, believed that no other group of the so-called rightist or leftist parties was able to unite people around a single cause. He says that in the horizon of Iran, there was no other person to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his invitation. Algar considers Imam Khomeini's courage very important in making hard decisions. He refers to Imam's firm link with religious establishments and his deep attention to Islamic wisdom and irfan, which is cognizance. The British thinker gives high role to Imam Khomeini's spirituality in his confrontation with enemies. Nikki Keddy was another Iranologue and researcher of West Asian studies from the University of California. She called the Islamic Revolution as Iran's cultural reaction to the unwanted presence of the American imperialism in the country. The American University lecturer says that the high level of dependence on the U.S. during the Shah regime caused innumerable economic calamities in Iran. This led to uniting of people by Imam Khomeini to stage a great revolution to cut off the hands of foreign occupiers in various domains of the country. Keddy highlights two characteristics as the main parts of Imam Khomeini's personality, namely being uncompromising and resolute. Armenian-American University lecturer Yervant Abrahamian is another thinker who has studied on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. In his opinion, although the Shah had made economic and social developments, he had forgotten to form a matching political structure. Like most thinkers, he too believes that Imam Khomeini played the main role in bringing the hearts of people together and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. For sure, his unprecedented popularity among people from all walks of life was very effective in this regard. Abrahamian, however, pays attention to Imam Khomeini's simple way of life as another feature of his disposition, alongside his being uncompromising against the illegal and illegitimate ruler. The American University lecturer says that the Imam ably caused potential powers among people to converge on a single course and mobilize them in the struggles to topple the oppressive and dependent regime. In continuation of reviewing the opinions of Western thinkers of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, we talked about the views of John Foran and Fred Holliday. John Foran, from the University of California in Santa Barbara, focuses on the despotism of the Pahlavi regime and the dominance of foreign powers, particularly the U.S., on Iran, as the two main causes of the Islamic Revolution. Reviewing the two revolutions of constitutionalist movements and oil nationalization during the past 1.5 centuries, he stresses that both movements failed due to the defeat of the people's resistance. He then goes on to say that Imam Khomeini's leadership was very effective and determining in the formation and victory of the Islamic Revolution. Irish University lecturer Fred Holliday also said in a speech in 2008 that the Islamic Revolution is the most modern revolution in the history of mankind, while it was a non-violent development. Like others too, he too is of the opinion that Imam Khomeini played a key role in the formation and triumph of the Islamic Revolution. He then continues that the transition of power after the Imam's passing away was a very great achievement in the history of the revolution and an unprecedented event in the history of Iran and the regional nations. He correctly says that the peaceful transition of power after the Imam's demise and the people's reaction to this was a prominent sign of his legitimacy and that of the Islamic Republic system. Holliday points to the ideological basis of the Islamic Revolution, such as independence seeking, convergence of Islam and democracy, strengthening of Iranian identity, and so on, and considers Imam Khomeini's simple way of life and his honesty as the most important factors for his unmatched popularity among world leaders. A noteworthy point in Fred Holliday's views is that he seriously distinguishes between the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini and the extremist and savage views of Taliban and Al-Qaeda Salafis. He maintained that Iran enjoys a very rich and bright history and owns a very lofty cultural, economic, political, and scientific status among the regional nations.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone. Let us listen to a mind-stimulating saying from the Holy Prophet's seventh infallible successor, Imam Musa Kazim, peace be upon him. The light of the body is in the eyes. If the sight is luminous, the whole body will be bright. The light of the spirit is in the brain. If a person is really intelligent, he will acknowledge his Lord. If he acknowledges his Lord, he will clearly see his religion. If he ignores the affairs of his Lord, he will be having no religion. Like the body that does not live without a living soul, the religion does not live without true conviction. True conviction is proved only through the mind.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how your soul is a clean tablet and you write on it what you wish. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service. Dear friends, we're talking about Islamic lifestyle on A to Z. So good to be here talking about Islamic lifestyle. So, dear friends, you know, one of the things that's really interesting is this idea and this reality that at the time of creation, the soul of a human being is like a clean tablet. And so when we're talking about the soul being a clean tablet, of course, you know, this means that every single one of us has a clean start. We have a fresh start. And yes, we can write what we wish upon this clean tablet. Now, a little bit about this tablet, this soul of ours, right? Yes, environment does play a role. And so it is very important for us, especially if we are parents, to make sure that the environment in which our children grow up in, the environment in which our children live in, this needs to be a good, pure, honorable, clean, you know, environment, not just physically, but spiritually. And so this is something that we have to be very cognizant of. We have to be very careful of. We don't want to raise our children in an environment that will be conducive towards committing sins. Because if, God forbid, we raise our children in an environment that is conducive towards sinning and evil and, you know, un-Islamic behaviors, then, of course, these things are then written upon the soul of that child. And so as they grow up, a lot of these things, they become ingrained within that human being. And of course, once these things become ingrained in a human being's soul, then it's very difficult to get rid of them. You know, when we talk about an Islamic lifestyle, these things are very important. In Islam, of course, even this idea of having children, you know, the things to take into consideration, they start from even before the child is born. So, you know, when the mother is expecting the child, or when the mother is suckling the child, in all these stages, the inputs that the soul of the child is receiving are very important. So again, we're talking about, you know, Islamic lifestyle and how it's very important for us to raise children in an environment, you know, that is conducive towards spiritual behaviors and moral and ethical virtues. This is in reality where we should be raising our children because, as we said, you know, the soul of a human being in the beginning is like a clean tablet. And so whatever you write upon it will be written upon it. And whatever you don't write upon it, it won't be written upon that pure, clean tablet. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about Islamic lifestyle and how to lead that beautiful Islamic lifestyle that we're all searching for. Now, one of the things that we're talking about, or really the primary thing and fundamental thing that we're talking about on the program, is this idea of how the soul of every human being is like a clean tablet in the beginning, meaning that there is no, you know, evil tendencies, there aren't any evil traits that are within this soul, meaning it is pure, and whatever is written upon this soul is what will be written on this soul, and whatever you wish is what is written upon that soul. And so that's why we had said in the previous segment, it's very important, you know, for us to make sure we raise our children in a environment which is conducive towards spiritual traits and moral and ethical virtues, so that that child and the soul of that child continues to become more and more perfect as time moves forwards, you know, on after each passing day. And on the other hand, we said that, you know, if we end up raising children in an environment which is conducive towards sins, then that is what's going to be written upon that soul. And so we write upon that soul of ours whatever we wish. Yes, environment does play a role, but the bigger role is our decisions and what we choose to do with our life, what we choose to write upon our soul in order to reach that ultimate Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will focus on Netanyahu's threats to attack Rafah and the possibility of military action there regarding the political issues and the captives. This is while the occupation regime has announced the release of two captives in Rafah in a complex military operation. In addition, there are ongoing contacts to conclude an exchange deal, as well as protests and demands to overthrow Netanyahu's administration to hold early elections. Regarding these topics, I welcome the specialist in Israeli affairs, Professor Ali Haida. Welcome to Israel Watch, dear Professor. So, after the occupation army announced the release of two captives in Rafah during a complex military operation, as they put it, the Zionists began advertising that we can address the issue of the captives without negotiations. But this event will not have a major impact on this issue. The impact of the release of the two captives on the issue of the entire captives have laid the groundwork for those who oppose the captives exchange deal to take advantage of this event and escalate their opposition. Professor Ali Haida, how do you assess the release of the two captives in Rafah in a complex military operation that was prepared for a long time, knowing that the two captives were in the possession of a Palestinian family, not Hamas, according to Osama Hamdan, the former senior representative of Hamas in Lebanon?
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful. In fact, Netanyahu needed such an achievement to justify his positions of refusing to submit to the demands of the Hamas movement in the negotiations in order to continue the genocide. However, the event, in its circumstances and the number of captives, does not change anything from the overall scene. Rather, we can say that it'll be just a passing event. For 2 or 3 days, the world will forget this achievement because 134 captives are still held by the Hamas movement. and therefore Netanyahu is looking for such tactical events here and there in order to influence public opinion and create for himself a solid foundation to continue the war. This war, in addition to its strategic dimensions, also favors Netanyahu personally. He needs this war to stay in power.
Professor Ali Haider, between the impact of the recent captives release operation and the captives exchange deal, how do you evaluate the Zionist approach regarding the captives?
There, the division still exists at the political level and at the popular level as well, to the point that for the first time in opinion polls, 51% of the Israeli population now supports an exchange deal, even if it comes at the expense of a ceasefire. This is a shift in public opinion that portends what Netanyahu fears. It heralds more transformations because protests are escalating among the families of the captives. All of this is due to the failure to achieve the goals declared so far, not only a failure with regard to eliminating the Hamas movement, which the United States has also begun to say is impossible, but also even at the level of liberating the captives. These could be serious achievements before the eyes of the public, but they have not happened so far.
Here it means that after more than 4 months, Netanyahu has been able to release only two captives, and his attempts have failed on previous occasions.
Yes, the two captives were not held by Hamas. There is news out there, but it needs to be verified. There are talks about a deal with those holding the captives and so on. These things are being said, but I want to emphasize that it is just a passing event whose impact is fleeting and does not change anything in the political scene. The problem is with Netanyahu. No matter how much he tries to find temporary solutions, the effects are not enough to bring stability for his administration.
Indeed, the protest against the way Netanyahu and members of his administration have dealt with the captives at the hands of the resistance in Gaza are escalating day after day. Demands have grown from an exchange deal to overthrowing Netanyahu's administration and holding early elections. Rarely does a session of the Zionist administration pass at the present time without disagreements, divisions, and tensions amongst its members over the management of this aggression against Gaza and the captives exchange deal that is being negotiated. In the last session, there was a rebuke from Netanyahu to ministers in Likud who did not oppose Hamas's terms for the exchange deal. Netanyahu's government is on its way to disintegration. If a deal is concluded for the exchange of the captives with the resistance, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich will withdraw from it. And if it is not concluded, Gantz and Eisenkot will withdraw from it. In both cases, the administration will disintegrate. According to the Zionist analyst, if the exchange deal is concluded or not, the Netanyahu administration is on the path to disintegration. Opinion polls say that 55% of Israelis want to go to early elections.
In fact, demanding early elections is what Netanyahu fears the most. And everything he does in security and politics is in order to avoid this scenario. But the administration structure may impose on him what he does not want and what is not in his interest. Here, I would like to refer to the significant point which was mentioned a moment ago. These early captives have become hostages of Israeli policy and the internal disputes within the administration. This is because it is not in Netanyahu's interest to push for this deal and put it on the negotiating table with his administration members. This will fire up the situation between the two parties. Therefore, we can say that Netanyahu is keen not to appear as someone who is opposed to the deal, but rather wants the opposition to come from the ministers, whether from his party or from outside his party, so that he is not facing the captives' families. This has greatly affected his public standing in this field.
And the occupation's decision to launch an attack on Rafah. The Hebrew media have revealed the plan of the occupation army for the attack, starting with the evacuation of the displaced either to the northern Gaza Strip or to Khan Yunis. The matter is related to negotiations for the captives' exchange deal. The decision to attack Rafah was taken around 2 weeks ago, and the occupation army is waiting for this political decision to be taken and the Egyptians fear large displacement operations to its lands. Mr. Ali Haider, the decision to attack Rafah was taken 2 weeks ago, and the Egyptians do not oppose, but they only fear the displacement problems. What do you think?
Unfortunately, the conditions of some Arab countries have become such that the root of the Israeli attack on the Palestinians is not revealed or exposed, but rather it is reflected on them in a direct sense. And this is unfortunate. This is what dares the Israelis to commit massacres and launch attacks. Regarding this area, however, it is possible to talk about more than one point. The Rafah issue is no longer a field issue par excellence, but it has become an interactive issue that is overlapping and interacting with two other problems, which are the issue of negotiations over the captives and the issue of tensions within the administration. Given that the issue of field pressure through Rafah is the political goal of its timing now, it is linked to the captives' negotiations to pressure Hamas to make a concession. Therefore, the more negotiations falter from the Israeli and even American perspective, the more pressure will be needed through Rafah. It seems that there is an indication of a solution if we might seek some kind of freeze in the field to one degree or another in this area. Therefore, we are facing an issue that has become more complex due to its interactions with other issues. This is in addition to the American position, which has become clear that it is not against the operation, and rather we need a different plan in one sense, and also regarding the Egyptians' concerns. We're facing a multi-dimensional event intertwined with more than one local and regional aspect.
I mean, it is very complicated. The recent contact between President Biden and the head of the Zionist regime, Netanyahu, regarding the attack on Rafah and the captives' exchange deal, these issues caught the attention of the Israeli media, which have detailed some of what was revealed. Mr. Ali Haider, did Netanyahu obtain Biden's approval regarding the attack on Rafah?
First, there was certainly no serious American opposition. Second, there was perhaps a disagreement about some details, not the origin of the Israeli attack. Third, this position is not denied by the United States, but rather it has become public that we're not against the military operation in Rafah, but rather we need a reliable parallel plan, in a sense, to protect, as they say, the civilians. It has become clear to everyone that protecting civilians means more casualties. This American hypocrisy is therefore a matter of tension. These are provocative expressions with which they want to fool the Arab world and Arab public opinion. Unfortunately, I think more than 30,000 martyrs and more than 60,000 wounded should be enough to expose this hypocrisy. However, we do not actually need these numbers in order to know the truth.
Hamas is present, fighting in the Gaza Strip and imposing the terms of the exchange deal, and the occupation is still unable to remove it. Professor Ali Haider, what do you think about what the Zionist analysts are saying, that the resistance in Gaza is still strong? This actually contradicts what Netanyahu says about the imminent and absolute victory in the war.
In fact, the origin of the American-Israeli performance confirms that the assistance to the resistance is still strong. This means that even Netanyahu talks about the need to enter Rafah. If they don't, they will be defeated, for example. It means that Hamas still has its combat, military, structural capabilities, etc. This shows that Netanyahu seeks to mislead the public opinion through creating new terms, such as an absolute victory. Professionals, not only professional journalists in Israel, but also those who have security records, believe that, yes, we understand the topic of victory. It exists in military terms, but there is no such thing as absolute victory, especially in the face of resistance movements. In addition, what does he mean by the term absolute? Is what happened in northern Gaza an absolute victory? Rockets are still being fired in northern Gaza, and operations are carried out against the occupation forces. Is this absolute victory? Is it what happens in Khan Yunis, where Israeli forces suffer deaths and injuries every day? Is this an absolute victory? This means that in Rafah, we will be witness to the same scenario. I mean, basically, it is necessary to inscribe it if there is a root of victory, not just absolute. Therefore, in addition, I would like to point out that the introduction of the term victory is also new in Israeli terminology. as an expression. I mean, the common term was decisiveness. It has a specific meaning. It has a specific physical meaning. It means eliminating the resistance capabilities, occupying their lands and preventing their building capabilities. They know that these terms have become a thing of the past. It is no longer possible to make a military decision with the resistance movements. They replace this term with the term victory because it is characterized by a degree of ambiguity.
Israel received the yellow card as Moody's has downgraded Israel's credit rating on war risk. This is in light of the economic difficulties that the regime is experiencing today as a result of the aggression against Gaza and the great economic losses that it's suffering. Israeli social media commented on Moody's decision and held Netanyahu and Smotrich responsible. These are some of the comments.
Lior.
The disaster administration demolished the foundation of Israel.
Anet.
We said this is ruin, and this is what has been happening since the establishment of the most failed administration in history.
Hiller.
Stupid finance minister. I didn't expect anything else.
Yavit.
Thanks to Netanyahu and Smotrich who brought us this destruction.
Bini.
Thank you, Mr. Economy and Security, for the gift you gave to the Israelis and their well-being.
What is your assessment, Mr. Ali Haider, of Moody's downgrading of Israeli credit, the yellow card that was shown to the regime, and the comments of a stupid finance minister for which Netanyahu and Smotrich hold all responsibility?
In fact, Smotrich is bringing the accusation on himself. Otherwise, the issue is not only related to the performance of the Minister of Finance, but rather there is a difficult military, economic, security, political reality, etc. All of these factors contributed to this new classification of Israel and the raising of the yellow card. But the most dangerous of them is that this classification is based on an assessment of the future events, not just present. Therefore, the issue of uncertainty about the future of the aggression on Gaza and the possibility of reaching some formula for a foreseeable period of time, or the issue of ambiguity regarding the Northern Front and where it will go, is what raised the level of risk among the parties responsible for this classification and made them take a step they had never experienced before. And this is a very difficult indicator for Israeli society as well as the regime.
The occupation army cannot wage a war against Hezbollah, which, after the Operation Al-Aqsa flood, was able to impose military operations and security threats on the occupation army and settlers along the northern front. Your comments in brief, dear professor.
In fact, Israel has now found itself in a dilemma. It is between the northern front, the southern front in Lebanon, and the southern Palestine front in the Gaza Strip. Thus, this link between the two fronts, in addition to the role played by Ansarullah in Yemen, and of course the Iraqi and Syrian fronts, have made it hard for Israel to make decisions. This is an operation for the first time by what is called the Axis of Resistance. This has introduced, in a way, a new stage of the conflict. Israel has found itself in the lowest position ever, and therefore it is trying to appease its anger through aggression here and there.
Professor Ali Haider, specialist in Israeli affairs, thank you very much for your participation in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you for your good follow-up. Take care.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Homes and camps are more than physical structures for Palestinians. They represent resistance, endurance, and the hope of return. That is why they are always a target. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, "What is a home in Gaza?" Rafat al-Arir, on October 13, 2023, said, "For example, when I say Israel targeted a home, what's a home? A home in America? In the UK? Two people, a couple, a kid, a dog? But in Gaza, a home is a generational building." Rafat, like so many other bright and unique spirits, departed Palestinians without having the chance to bid farewell, because the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza does not allow for loved ones to give a last embrace. Yet, there was one, albeit forced, farewell more than 80% of Gaza's inhabitants were able to bid, and that was the farewell to their homes. This was not the first time Palestinians have had to bid farewell to their homes and will not be let last, as long as an Israeli occupation remains and Palestine refugees are denied their self-determination and right of return. But what exactly is this Palestinian home Rafat talked about? What Rafat was referring to was 12 square kilometers room made of prefabricated material with a zinc roof given to Palestine refugees after they had endured tents when they were forcibly displaced from their homeland in 1948 and 1967, respectively. This room was provided for each refugee family on a 100 square meters plot of land in all Palestine refugee camps across the Near East, with the camps left to grow independently as a space and people inside a bordered piece of land deemed politically temporary. More specifically, what Rafat was referring to was the Palestinian shelter in the Palestine refugee camp. Today, more than 1.5 million people live in 58 recognized Palestinian camps across Gaza, the West Bank, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. In Gaza alone, 80% of its 2.1 million population are refugees, half of whom still inhabit refugee camps. A dedicated UN agency, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, was established in 1949 to service Palestinian camps and refugees while maintaining a temporary status, regardless of how long these refugees would have to inhabit these camps. Furthermore, unlike its sister agency, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, which attends to all other refugees of the world, UNRWA is denied a political mandate to take an active role in repatriating Palestine refugees to their homeland. This political paralysis was reinforced through downsizing the political agency of the UN General Assembly adopted right of return, as exemplified in the preceding resolutions. The original text of Article 11 in Resolution 194, adopted in December 1948, maintained that the General Assembly resolved that the refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be permitted to do so at the earliest practicable date, and that compensation should be paid for the property of those choosing not to return and for loss of or damage to property which, under principles of international law or in equity, should be made good by the governments or authorities responsible.